happened? Would this happen with soul or something?
I didn't listen. When we...
when you get married, yeah. You're marrying your other part, right? So you become whole, right?
Right.
Right, so when you're in the afterworld, that you're as one with the other entity or the other being?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't have the answer, no. But definitely there is some relation. Definitely.
Is there reincarnation? Are we reincarnated?
What was the reincarnation?
Well, coming back to Earth, live life again to better ourselves.
It's mentioned that there is. But I don't think this is one of the 13 principles that is conditioning our being part of the Jewish people. Okay. Believing this.
Some principle?
It's not of the 13 principles. There are the 13 principles. You can find in the Siddha the 13 animaimis. In every Siddha you find it. So there are many things which are true. But if I make the mistake not to accept them, it's my mistake, but it does not hurt my identity as a Jew. That's what I meant to say. Is it clear? Yes.
Can I ask you a question about identity as a Jew?
Yeah.
We're talking about this. The question of different minhagim and different nusachs between the Jewish people.
Yeah.
I have an interesting situation. It actually happened to me, so I'm quite aware of problems it can cause. My background is Sephardi.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought up in a country which is Ashkenazi, being brought up with the tradition of Ashkenazi in Haider, a home Sephardi, pronunciation Sephardi, but my Nusach Ashkenaz until a while back when I changed everything. What is one thing I never understood from the Rabbanim, and they were not particularly easy, it wasn't a particularly easy question to ask them, was What is the significance of the Nusach? And what is its spirituality? And why do we have to have different Nusachs, the Jewish people? Why can't we be one complete Am Yisrael with one Nusach?
You want to know why? Yeah, first, let me tell you a story. I happened to be invited to a Shavuot Brachos, arranged by Chabad. The young people were brought by the Tshuva, Chabad, and Chabad arranged for them. At the Sheva Brachos, there was a conservative rabbi over there, an elderly person, and he asked me, he says, you come from Litva, you're a Litva Shayid. What do you have in common with Chabad? So I told him, it's mentioned in Chumash. When it says, when the Jewish people left Egypt, it says, Etzem Hayom Hazeh, and this very day, Yotzu Tzivus Hashem, the armies of Hashem, left the country of Egypt. So now I know that we are an army. An army has more than one formation. Could be a navy, could be marines, could be air force. So therefore, I and Chabad belong to different formations of the same army. We appreciate each other as belonging to the same army. Then the rabbi asked me, what are we the conservatives? I say, if you ask me, I think you are the deserters of the army. but that's the end was just was a joke of it, which may be true. Yeah, but the idea is true that we are an army, and as an army, we are multicolored. It's not a monotonous army. Not everybody. As a matter of fact, I think we had a very similar mistake in America. You people who come from America may be familiar with the term the melting pot. Didn't you?
I'm English, actually.
Huh?
I come across.
Well, because today it's not, it was an idol, the melting, especially for the Jews, was an idol that we have to assimilate in America. They did not understand that America is not a melting pot. America is a multicolored society. And the richness of that society is that that the Italian is an Italian. And that the Jew is a Jew.
In Canada, they were a cultural mosaic.
Huh?
In Canada, they were a cultural mosaic.
Fine. This is true. So then, and in some forum, I saw that it's mentioned that in heaven, where the cherubs are going up, there are 12 gates for the 12 shvatim. Which is, it's almost the same idea. And this, there should be that, those nushchois. So the practical question is to a person, which one? You have a question.
I've got a question.
Huh?
I have a question which is related, if you'd like me to ask you.
Yeah?
If you're in a community, which is predominantly Ashkenaz and follows the Ashkenaz mentality, and yet you're a sole Sephardi, and at home you practice Sephardi customs with regard to the Hagim and your Tefillot. How do you mix the two? Should you mix the two? Should you be separate? Should you be part of the Kehillah? Or how should you act in public?
Now, let's talk to the Mishnah first. The Mishnah is talking about, and the example of Mishnah is Erev. Erev Pesach in the morning, there are customs, whether you do work or not. What is it? The day when a person is bringing a korban into the Beis HaMikdash, that day is for him Chol HaMoed. It's a festive day. It's not like Shabbos, not like Yom Tov, but it is like Chol HaMoed. There are things which you can do Chol HaMoed, you can do, and things which you don't do. Let's say some people stay away from writing in Chol HaMoed, something. Now, Erev Pesach, every Jew was bringing a korban. So the Erev Pesach was in Chol HaMoed for every Jew in the Beis HaMikdash for that. But you cannot bring the korban Pesach before noon. So therefore, the day of the korban starts noontime. So Erev Pesach, starting noon, it should be like Chol HaMoed. And even though we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have, but this, we are observing that Erev Pesach, let's say if somebody has to take a haircut, you should take it in the morning, not in the afternoon. Some places made a custom to observe from the morning to observe. So the Mishnah says, if one travels and from a place which starts the Chol HaMoed in the morning to a place starts in the afternoon or just then, vice versa. So the Mishnah says he has to take the stricter sides of each one. But then the Mishnah says, but don't act to be different than others. This is not, it's not good manners to be different than others. So the Gemara says, what does it mean? If you come from a place where they start the day, the Chol HaMoed in the afternoon. And you come from a place where you don't work, people will not think that you are different. People think that you just don't have one. So this gives us some guideline that really we should stick to our custom. And we should try to act as if we are. I had a child like this. I came last Shavuos, I was in New York. Now I am observing one day Yontif already for the last 8 years. I went to shul. Nobody noticed what Shemin Esrei I said. During Musaf, I acted as if I'm saying Shemin Esrei. But I downed my one davening. I mean, that's the guideline. Now in davening, we can daven our own siddur. I have the same thing. I daven Nusach Ashkenaz, and I have near my house daven Nusach Sfar, Belza Hasid. They don't notice what I am saying. But Tachman, I say the way they say it, because it would be noticeable. Kedusha, I say their Kedusha. The Shemin Esrei, nobody hears what I am saying. I follow my own. And nobody notices that instead of starting from Hoidu, I start from Mizmor Shel Chanukah.
That's explained it to me.
Pardon?
It's explained the problem in my mind.
Yeah, that's clear. Yes.
Let's say my great grandfather was Orthodox. He was Ashkenazi.
Yeah. And he was?
Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
And I learned on my father's side, that makes me Ashkenazi. Does that mean that I have no choice but to be taken into the ranks of, let's say, the paratroopers or the tanking?
I am not qualified to answer a question like this. But there are people when I have a shayla like this, I either go to Rabbi Auerbach or to Rabbi Yosef here in. Those are the two people I would consult in a question. You know who they are?
Yeah. Okay. One other question. With regard to the tradition of we're commanded to the Rabbanan to find, to seek out a Rebbe and to hold by that one Rebbe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it says one Rebbe, I think.
I don't know.
Because throughout history, the Gedolim,
yeah,
had one Rebbe, and that Rebbe was then mentioned. Does that mean that is the pattern that we're all to follow?
I don't know. The Gemara said that for Mishnah, they used to learn Mishnah by heart. So the Gemara says for Mishnah, you should have one Rebbe, because you'll be confused. Keep one Rebbe, and then you remember exactly the text has it. But when it comes to Gemara, wander around. Because you can always pick up some logical method which one uses and the other doesn't have. So the Gemara says, Rabbi the Gemara says you should have a few. Wander around. Now, you are talking about Rebbe as a one who guides you in your practical life. That's it. It's hard to say, you know, we have to have
There's no, you know.
I don't know.
Set, there's no law. I mean, there are those who say, find a...
Well, but I'll tell you. I was raised in Lithuania. I was not exposed to Hungarian rabbanim, to Hungarian yeshivas, great yeshivas in Hungary. There are some sefer tradition, it's very great. But we were not exposed to them. In our area, we had quite a number of rabbis in learning. Each, let's say, Reb Chaim Brisker was very analytically very sharp. And it was a school. As a matter of fact, here in Yerushalayim, they still have the Brisker school, but they follow the tradition from Brisk. Then there was Rav Shimon Shkop, was very logical. Then there was quite a number of Rosh Yeshivas. When it came to the outlook, everybody had the same. To the outlook and how to evaluate conditions in Jewish life and how to understand correct behavior of a person, ethical behavior, all the same. But in learning, each one had his method, and each one had his perspective. So I had no problem of selecting, because all the rabbis I knew when it came to outlook were all the same. And now, when I grew up, I met already Hungarian people, but I was placed on a track. So for me, today, if you ask me, who would be my rabbi today? Again, Al Yosef and Auerbach. And I know there are other very great men, but the school that I come from is closer to when you're a journal. Yes.
Rabbi, what should be our relationship with the Goyim? And in the case of Chas V'Shalom, where a brother or a sister marries a Goy, what should be our relationship with them?
This is a very tragic question. There are a few angles to consider for their good. If I sympathize with somebody, he may change later. If I reject him totally, he's on his own. I mean, that's one thing. On the other hand, there are certain things which we cannot, which we cannot accept. There is such a thing like machor, a protest. Sometimes the protest is necessary in order not to identify with a certain thing. And we definitely cannot identify with intermarriage. It's a very thing.
Can I ask you a related question? I've always wondered, when a convert comes into the Jewish religion, righteous Gentile converts to Judaism.
Yeah, yeah.
What is his relationship to his parents who are Gentiles?
What's his relation to his parents? I think his relation should be definitely with respect.
But they could, they definitely might be advising him. They may say be Roman Catholics, and he's now a Jew. I mean,
so he has to watch himself from missionary influence.
But he should try.
He owes them all respect. There is nothing wrong for a non-Jew to be a non-Jew. It's wrong for a Jew to be a non-Jew. You understand? So therefore, he owes him all respect.
We come back to what we were talking before.
Yeah.
The relationship. We should assume to somebody who has actually intermarried or has gone away from Judaism and perhaps taken up a different religion or, I mean, primarily intermarried. We continue.
Huh? Then that's not his question, that's your question. Yeah. There are several situations. Let's say, how is this going to influence my children? If in a certain way I display some acceptance. And that's a problem. And maybe because of my children, I can't afford it. I have to stay away. On the other hand, those people who intermarry, if you ask me about them, 90% or more of them are not to be blamed for it. You know that? I remember a boy from San Diego running yeshiva who tells me his sister started going with the sailor. And I knew why. Because that girl was not exposed to anything. Why shouldn't she go around with the sailor? So I wanted to send her to a camp, summer, just not suggest she'd go to Camp Pnos or Camp Yaakov in the Catskill Mountains. And I wrote to a friend of mine, and I asked him to help me get her into the camp. Then I received a letter, he says, What kind of people are you going to push into our camps? I asked. So I told him, what do you want? On the west coast, people who don't intermarry are the exception. Because they had no background. And they're blameless. And they are fine people. Expose them to Yiddishkeit and they will know. So we have to realize that in many instances we are dealing with people who are not to blame, who can't be blamed. But it's a pity that we have to a certain extent stay away. Yeah.
Okay. For all the children, someone who comes from nothing,
yeah,
and has become religious, to find a wife, you think it is a good thing to have shidduch made, or is that not the way to go? What do you think? For a bali tshuva to find a mate, what is the best way?
Yeah. What should be against it? What is your consideration to be against it?
Still. Even though you become bali tshuva, it looks like you still carry some dirt with you from before, some influence, like you used to be. That maybe shidduch is for the old country, for, you know. I'm asking what you think is the.
I don't understand the question.
What is the best way a person should get married? Find his wife.
Yeah. whether it should be recommended by others or he should find himself. Is that what you are asking? Huh?
Yeah.
Neither one is wrong. I have seen in many cases that shidduchim which were recommended ended up to be very happy. Let me tell you something. It's very hard to find a mate. Why? Because every person for himself would like to have the best. He would like to have a dream. All and everything, the best. It's nobody like this. So what the Rebbe Yisrael do? Around the ages of 18, 20, 25, something like that, people become blind. And they see somebody and they think it's the most ideal person in the world. So they fell into the trap. And that's it. And that's how I could work on my shidduch. And it works out. And now, if my parents select somebody for me, they don't have the eyes blind as mine. And on the other hand, they already have that much experience to know that you can't want to have everything good. So you pick out something. So sometimes it pays to follow the advice of parents. Sometimes, Sonny. Because it's so frequent that parents are looking for a match. He wants to have a nice machutin. How do you call machutin?
Right.
He himself would like to go into a family that he wants to rub shoulders with. So he forget the kids' need. He thinks about his own need. Then the album is led. It's not always. And then parents really, it's practical to listen to an advice from parents, but see that they have an authority to dictate us, they don't. Because all the obligations that we have for our parents is concerning their way of life. But they were not given the authority to mix in my way of life. Is it clear what I say? On the other hand, it's their obligation to raise me, to train me. It's prescribed how to train me. It starts how the Gemara has the obligations a father has for his child. Circumcise him, first boy. Train him to be a bar mitzvah, to be a good character. Teach him Torah. Teach him a trade. Marry him off. Once you marry him, let him start worrying about his own children. Yeah. But it's an obligation. And it's very interesting that in the Gemara, there are two paragraphs. One paragraph is what the father is obligated for his son. The other paragraph is what the son is obligated to his father. But the first one is the father to the son. Why? Because if the father would not carry out his obligations for his son would never know how to carry out his obligations for him. That's the generation gap which we experience today. The parents have not raised their children to know their obligations. And for some of their children, they want the old folks know. They know that. That's happening. I didn't answer clearly the question because I'm lost. That question, what you ask, there are so many angles to it. But I know that we have to stay away as much as we can. And for the other hand, I should not be angry. I may have pity, but not be angry. Especially today, people are innocent, are not? Yes.
Father's obligation.
Pardon?
What were you talking about just now about the father's obligation?
Yeah.
And the son. So how should one feel when he discovers the Torah, say at age 20 or older? How should he feel towards his parents? How should he feel
to his parents? I think I have suggested a few times that we should have a special course here in Kibbutz. It's our obligation to respect our parents. And on the other hand, in most cases, if our parents are not, let's say, observant people, in most cases, they are not to be blamed. Nobody raised them. And what's happening today is a miracle. They grew up in a time before the miracles happened. You know, today it is that true movement is a miracle. And it started maybe the very, very beginning must have been about 25 years ago. I can't look back more. Yes?
Yes.
I thought you wanted to say something. So therefore, we can't blame our parents. But on the other hand, in America, it's very easy. In America, that concept that every person has a right to live his own life. So I would my parents the same. I have my love for them, my respect for them, auntie. But when it comes to my way of life, I choose it. Is it clear what I said?
That can put you actually in a very difficult situation.
Oh, yeah.
For example, if you're an observant Jew, a son is an observant Jew.
Yes.
But the parents aren't. They're traditional. For example, they make Kiddush on Shabbat. But afterwards, right, they perhaps decide, oh, well, they want to go and visit some friends. Or they want to have, for example, they want to have television on. Or, for example, on Pesach. Yes, sure, they have a Seder, but yet they put the Kesevah in the music. I mean, there's situations where you can go on and on. It puts the son or the children in a very difficult position to either compromise on their religious foundations, or although Kibbutz Avraham is one of the basic tenets.
Kibbutz Avraham does not permit me to compromise. Does not. I love my parents, but I think I should compensate by showing more warmth, more love, more concern for them. But I know my way of life, this is my way of life. And this is why a few times I suggested that Nurse Amir, they should have a class in Kibbutz. Have a course in Kibbutz. Because it's very important, and it's very important because we have a different way of life. To have a lot of warmth for them, a lot of concern, and they should feel it. And at the same time, we should know that we don't compromise. Yes.
shouldn't we also, to a certain extent, try to expose them without, in the most productive way we can, to what we're learning?
Yeah, now let me tell you first. If I want to change somebody else's way of life, I would like to know why. Is it my interest or is it in his interest? I read sometimes, I may have it in file, a great educator in America wrote that all education is salesmanship. I agree. Now, if you ask me what I think of a salesman, I don't have the highest opinion. Why? Nobody notices it. It's definitely forbidden according to the Torah. The Torah says, "V'lif na'iv alesit en rishon." Don't put a stumbling block in front of a blind. Rashi explains. Don't mislead the blind. Don't tell a person he should sell his property while you wait to buy it. It means if somebody asks you an advice, advise him what's good for him, not what's good for you. Is it clear? Now when a shoe salesman keeps on hammering on me that his shoes are the best shoes in the world, it's the best bargain, and he keeps on telling me that it's very good for me, and all he wants is to make a sale. This is not what the Torah says. You hear what I say? And I'm trying really to think about, because so many Jewish people are good salesmen and make a nice living out of it. Do they break the law or not? And I'm trying to rationalize that since everybody knows what a salesman is, he doesn't fool. But I think it's just a rationalization. He fools, but he wouldn't fool. He would have no business. But in any case, to say salesmanship, it's accepted. It's commonly accepted. But when I look in the world, I look in Chumash, I look in Rashi. It's not so simple. It's not so simple. When is it? When the salesmanship is for the good of the salesman. But if the salesmanship is for good of the buyer, then it's ethical. Huh? And the Rambam has that example. He starts about the teacher and the student. You know that? He shows you how people are dealing with each other and each one from a different background. He says, the teacher wants the students to learn a chapter. Do you know that? So he says, boy, when you know that chapter, I'll give you a piece of candy. And the boy doesn't. So what's important for the boy? For the boy is important, the candy. He pays for the candy by studying a chapter. What's important for the teacher? The chapter. He pays for learning the chapter with candy. The Rambam goes on with it. That analysis. But is it wrong to offer a child a candy and others should learn? It's not wrong. Why? Because I'm doing it not for my good, I'm doing it for his good. That's why I was thinking about education is salesmanship. There's no question about it. Education is salesmanship. But on the other hand, Torah education. I do it for his good, not for my good. Then it's honest. Now, if I want, I'm an observant Jew, I want another Jew to become an observant. I should first start thinking, what is it? What's my motivation? My good or his good? It may be my good. Right after the war, There was a rabbi in Long Island by the name of,
Finkelstein?
No, no, Finkelstein wasn't it. I forgot his name. He has a son now in the University of Judaism. Forgot his name. So that, he was a famous conservative rabbi. He came out that we have to go to Japan and do some missionizing over there and get some Japanese to become Jews. Gordis was their name. Rabbi Gordis. Why? If he really wants people to become Jews, be Jewish. His own congregation was a lot. He could have done a lot. He has to go to Japan. What's the answer? The answer is that the secular Jew is always concerned with the weak position of the Jew in the human society. And then he thinks that we are a minority. If the more people will have on our side, the more will be respected, the more will have power. So he wants to take a couple of other thousand Japanese, make them Jews, so his army will become stronger. Same thing is with here with Aliyah. In a way, you're familiar with it. The whole propaganda for Aliyah. They don't care for the Olay. They want to have to populate the country, and I don't know why. Because I have a feeling that this country is driven by drunk drivers now. I don't know what they want. But still, they are talking about the Aliyah and spend so much money on Aliyah. I know that it's not for the good of the Olay, because I know how he's being treated. I heard him, your cousin. And I know why the Russian people don't want to come here, because how the others are treated here. I mean, but they do it in order to build up the country. This is that unethical salesmanship. I understand. Now here is a son. He wants his father and his mother, he is about Shuvah, he wants his father and his mother to become observant. Why? It's because we found something which is a treasure, and we want my father should miss it. Why should my father have the same? Then I really am concerned about his good. Or, on the other hand, I'm coming home, I feel inconvenient, I feel out of place, I would like my parents to be with me, then I'll be more good. Then it's a different story. Huh? And I want to analyze, I said it intentionally, that we should analyze what we want. I think we have no right to want to change anybody's life in order to make, to gain convenience for ourselves. On the other hand, definitely, every Jew, every Jewish person, who's eyes we can open, and I tracked him to a Torah, true life, will make him happy. And will make his life meaningful. So first I would like that we should be clear, we should forget ourselves. When we do anything for other people, let's forget ourselves and concentrate on God. I would say that we do very little about it. Why? The chicken resents the egg telling the heart. And I'll just call for a reaction. I remember years ago, around the time before Tisha B'Av, before people are going home, and I was talking to people, I suggested, don't bring a book home and say, Dad, I want to read it. Now I want to read it. They don't want you to teach them. If you would like your mother to read a book, bring that book for yourself. The parent, he must be crazy what a kid is reading. So she'll read it. You have to be very careful, you have to be very sensitive not to put people under the fence. This is very important because what's happening, some parents think that a kid is criticizing them. And this alienates me. I should be fearless, I should behave in such a way that I display great respect for them. And it needs a lot of skill and sensitivity how to carry this out. And I wouldn't see anything wrong if there would be a course just in this. With the halachas of Kibbutz Avraham. That's what I felt.
The reason I ask the question is because both my brother and sister, I have more siblings, but my brother and sister aren't about shuvas. And in the
and they are.
They are.
Yeah.
My mother was brought up in an Orthodox family.
Yeah.
Up until like high school. When she got married.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Since then it hasn't been. So I guess that's like 35 years she wasn't from.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't convenient. So it just disappeared. Now she's observant again. And she has friends in she's friends with Eberson Freifeld. She goes there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She's taking classes. She's gonna come here for a little while.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it was a slow, in the beginning it was, there were certain like rams
yeah.
in the beginning. But then, she just saw.
Fine.
But I think the question comes down to does the means justify the end?
Which?
Does what we were talking about selling, or the means, does the way of accomplishing
something? I think they are talking the other way around. I say that the end justify the means.
Excuse me. That's the question.
Huh?
That's the question.
Yeah. Is that the end of it?
That's the question. Does the end justify the means? I mean, I hear people arguing that Eishet Torah, the discovery program, a lot of people have told me after coming out of it that they think that they're cramming too much. I mean, it's Torah, it's MS, but the way they're doing it, they feel that they're being brainwashed or manipulated or there's, so they say that Torah's the end. But does the means, if you're gonna cram it down somebody, and you're gonna expose it to a person in such a way that they kind of lose balance, is it then appropriate?
I don't know why you use that language of means and end. It's a different story. Means and end is something else.
So is it better not to expose someone to Torah, or to expose them to Torah? Maybe they're not the most ethical way.
Not. But we don't force ourselves on people. And we have, if we want, first I said, the very first thing that I mentioned before, is we have to try to make clear to our minds that we don't do it for ourselves. I constantly do it for them. Then how to do it? I have to be very, very sensitive. And it says, and people don't understand it. People, when they want to impress somebody, they start shouting. And the louder he talks, the less he impresses. What we make. And just by being gentle, we impress more. So we have to be careful. Excuse me, you wanted to say something before. Yes, please. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
We're not supposed to force ourselves on anyone. We're not supposed to force yes. on anyone. But if you feel a little bit, you feel like that after you read some of the chapters on the blessings and the curses in the Torah, and some of the harsh statements in the Talmud about those who do not learn Torah, those who do not keep. I mean, and that makes you feel...
I'll tell you. I wish I had I would have a Rami. Well, I'll give you just a reference. Have somebody learn it with you. Rambam, Hilchos Mamrim. Mamrim are rebels. It comes, I'll tell you where it is in Rambam. In Rambam, it's in the last volume. It follows first the halachas of Sanhedrin, that's the courts, then comes Eidus, witnesses, and after this comes Ramam, rebels. Third chapter, first three paragraphs to study. Yeah. What else?
Question.
Yeah.
Is it a mitzvah for Jewish people to live in Israel, whether it be Medinat Israel or Eretz Israel? Is it a mitzvah for us to come and live here?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Decide whether it's a mitzvah. Now, we should know that Eretz Israel and Medinat Israel are two different things.
What is Medinat?
Huh?
The
state
of Israel.
The Israel and Eretz Israel are two different things. I am here not because I have an interest to be in Israel. I have no interest to be in Israel. And there is no reason I should have an interest. Because economically, that country is crazy. Plain crazy. Businesses are failing. It's an epidemic of failures of businesses. It's the most expensive country in the world. You want to buy a car. The most expensive. A car which I could buy for $10,000-$12,000 in America would cost me up $20,000 at least. The same thing with any electronic device. It's the most expensive country in the world. I'll tell you my own experience. I came 8 years ago, and for some reason, at that time I had the rights to bring in a car, customs free. Mrs. Wasserman was against me. So I didn't. So since then I'm a pedestrian. Now I can't afford to buy. It's impossible. Health insurance, the poorest in the world. Living quarters, there are no rentals. You have to purchase. And if you don't have money, you have to go to a bank and take a mortgage. And if you take a mortgage in a bank, people don't know it. It's a trap for life. And I'll explain you why. Because the mortgage that you are getting is linked. The linkage, and it's not linked to currency. It's linked to the cost of living. And the cost of living is a blind thing. So the bank can tell you that the cost of living has nothing to do with the official statements. By the end of every month, there is a statement how much the cost of living went up. It has nothing to do with the reality. Why? Because the bread goes up 20%. good picks are going down 40%. And then they balance out. Huh? But I don't live on toothpicks, I live on bread. So for me it's 30%. This is exactly what they said. The banks say it. The banks say, we don't care. The real index went up. So your purchase power, when you borrow money, the bank, the linkage means that you owe purchase power, not money. Then you started out with 200 shekel a month. After a few months, you are getting a raise because the index went up. So you pay already 250, 260. But the people don't know that not only the payments went up, the indebtedness also went up. Because you owe purchase power. So here is a case of a man. That's how it came to me, to my attention. He comes and tells me, he don't know what happened to him. He borrowed in May, '85, he borrowed an equivalent of $20,000 for his apartment, buying his apartment. He came to me, was already in August of '86, a year ago. But August of '86, he paid already, he made payments which were equivalent to about $7,000. His debt rose from $20,000 to $28,000. So this is unheard of in the entire world. In America, if I borrow money in a bank, and my payments are interest only, my debt stays, and then it's a balloon payment. If I pay interest plus, my capital decreases. But you make payments and your capital increases. This is unheard of. And this is the practice here. Thousands and thousands of people fell into that trap. So why should I have no interest to be here. That's economically. And spiritually, not only this. A fellow in television in New York made a statement. He had only one deal with an Israeli, and that's good enough for him to tell everyone to stay away from Israelis. This happened June 1987. That statement on television in New York. So Israel does not attract me. But I sit here because I want to be in Eretz Yisrael. Whether it's for the mitzvah of Eretz Israel, or for the fact that even if I live in Bopa, and I go on and Shabbos on 16th Avenue is Shabbos, it's not the Shabbos that I see in Matosdorf, and not the Shabbos that I see in Nebrak and Abakiva. And the values of people, the people that I associate with. Take a look here in Osameach. Don't you feel that there is a concern of people for each other? Don't you have that feel? Huh? Israel doesn't have such a concern. Israel is just the opposite. Just the opposite. I sit in Eretz Yisrael, whether it's for the mitzvah, or for the the joy of Jewish life, which I can have here in my circles, on my island. And I paid the price of being in Israel. It so happens that, me personally, that price is not too much. The only thing, why? Because I have my income from America. And I purchased an apartment years ago. I didn't have to go into mortgages. I have none. That's the problem. So I saved for myself. Anybody else, it's a big sacrifice. For me, it's also because it hurts you. Last night, I was at a wedding at the Merkaz. Are you familiar with the Merkaz? So, they used to have the chuppah outside. Now they're building over there. So they had a chuppah and the lot, and a parking lot. A horn was blowing all the time of the chuppah, and deafening. And I thought it's some driver who came to pick up somebody from the hotel, and he signaled the hotel. But all the time of the chuppah, after the chuppah, the man jumps out of his car, says, "Why do you make a chuppah here? People still wanted to go over their cars." Now, that man was not facing the chuppah, he was facing away from the chuppah. He could go out. Now, at least, if you want to protest, go down to the hotel and protest to the hotel for doing it. But you disturb people in their simcha of a chuppah. People have a consideration.
Easier.
Yeah. You understand? I pay the price, but I want to be an artist.